got Gareth Bliss on the phone. Gareth is from the UK, and he was one of our early contacts with Oddball Pilot before we had the network or anything else going on. And for me, I would say some of the emails actually got me even more interested in talking to more people who are doing this kind of work and interested in this kind of work. I think it was instrumental in kind of keeping the website going. Last spring, I met up with Gareth in the UK, and we looked at a plane that he's bought a percentage of. It's a World War II reconnaissance rescue plane called a PBY or a Catalina, and he was flying that plane around Europe at air shows. So we're just going to talk to Gareth about what his experiences were like flying the Catalina and maybe dig into the JAR and some European flying issues as well. So, Gareth, how's it going?
Going brilliantly. You know, I actually can't believe that I'm actually flying a Catalina and flying an old Warbird for the Duxford Imperial War Museum, which I visited as a child. And, you know, for years and years, I've been to air shows and seen these old Warbirds flying. It's always been in the back of my mind that is something I'd really, really love to do. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, last summer, I just had to pinch myself because suddenly there I was at big air displays flying an old Warbird, which, you know, I could not have imagined, really, I'd ever be doing. It was only in my wildest dreams. Yeah.
That's what it's, I haven't been to that many old, actually any airstrips before I went to Duxford with you. And that was one of the cooler aviation days I've had. I mean, the World War II was the pinnacle of piston engine aircraft development. I mean, we really haven't gone that much further since then. And man, just sitting there with you and the Catalina and, the P-47s and the Spitfires and the Hurricanes, all this kind of, was just, that was pretty cool. So I'm jealous.
Yeah, I remember the day well because, you know, I was sitting in the chaise lounge at the back of the Catalina in the Vista Ballistas and looking out and seeing a B-17 parked and we had various different Second World War fighters landing and taking off and doing displays and afterwards we had a walk around and had a chat with a Hurricane pilot. You know, it's the sort of thing that dreams are made of, and you know, I'm just so fortunate to have landed in this opportunity to be able to get in the right hand seat of one of these old Warbirds and rubbing shoulders with all of these highly experienced pilots and learning an awful lot. It's been fantastic. Yeah.
Cool, that's excellent. So how did you get into the Catalina? What was the process?
Yeah, well, you know, my sort of route into aviation has been a long one. You know, I began flying way back when I was 16 in 1981, when I was in the Air Cadets. I did a gliding proficiency, and then shortly after that, I did an RAF flying scholarship, which then led on to a PPL. But unfortunately, I fell off a motorbike, and that kind of put my military flying career into a nosedive. But nevertheless, I kept my PPL. I was also accepted into the Royal Navy as a pilot, but again, the knee injury put paid to that. I was had a start date, the 5th of November 1985, but was subject to medical fitness on time of entry. But yeah, I got kicked out of that as well. So I managed to sort of keep my PPL going on and off for many years, but in the meantime, I went into various different careers and businesses. But then, when was that? around 2005, I decided that I wanted to go back into aviation, so I took the 14 ATPL exams, and I renewed my PPL, and I took my night rating, I built my hours, and I went on to take the multi-CPL, multi-IR, and then went on to do the NCC multi-crew cooperation course on 77200 at Park, and that was all with a view to getting a job as an airline pilot. But I turned the big 40 at that point, and as I put my CV out, I wasn't getting any responses. So you know, before I lost my shirt, which you can imagine after 19 months of training and around £60,000 worth of costs, you know, I had to go back to work. So I spent the next 5 years back in IT, and then before my ticket ran out, because a UK CPL runs out and is renewing after 5 years, you know, my multi-engine instrument rating had completely run out, my multi-engine piston rating had completely run out. I'd spent a lot of time and money on all these things, so I needed to renew those, so I did that. And then I didn't really do anything with it again. But then there was July 2012 or August 2012 when I was at an air show at Duxford, and I saw the Catalina doing its air display, and over the tannoy they were explaining that this aircraft was privately owned, and that there was one share going, and that the shareholder pilots actually get to fly this aircraft, and they get to fly it at air shows all over the UK and Europe. And that was the point when I just stood up and marched up to where I knew the aircraft was going to be parked at the end of its display. And I had a chat with Rod Brooking, who was the captain that day, and asked him, how do I go about getting a share in this aircraft? He said, give Paul Warren Wilson a call, who's the head cheese and one of the founders. Give him a call and talk to him. So within half an hour, I was sitting in the car in the car park on the phone to Paul, saying to him, I want that share. And the rest from then on was a case of obviously paying for my share in the aircraft, and then doing the type rating, and then once I had the type rating, I was then qualified to as a co-pilot with a land-based type rating to be able to co-pilot air shows.
Go ahead, Mike. I want to say one thing. I think a lesson for people from this is the specifics of the fact that it's owned by a group of people and that, you know, you bought a share and all that. That's just specific to this situation. But I think a lesson that applies to anybody looking for any sort of work in aviation, or, you know, seeing somebody flying an airplane and thinking, oh, I would love to do that, is you took the action of just going and talking to them and asking that question, how do I do what you do? And I think so many people, you know, you see from afar these exciting things that you wish you could do. And it may be flying a specific airplane that you see somewhere or flying in a specific place. And people think it's really complicated and that people don't want to talk to them. But I've heard so many stories about people doing just what you did, which is just take action and take the step and start chatting with somebody. And before you know it, doors are opening. And then a couple of years later, you find yourself doing what you're doing. Does that ring true to you?
Yeah. You've got to just be open to opportunity, and you've got to be qualified as well. I couldn't be doing what I'm doing now had I not put the effort into gaining an ATPR. It's not to say that you can't fly a Catalina on a PPL. I mean, I know someone flies a Vulcan on a PPL. But that's because it's true. You just got to be open to opportunity, and you just got to have the balls to seize that opportunity when it comes up. To be perfectly honest, when they said, the cost of this share is going to be £17,500, I said, yep, no problem. And then I walked off and worried about how the hell I was going to raise that money. But I just knew I was not going to get this opportunity any other way. And I did raise the money. So, that's the thing.
That fits with, I just talked to a group of college kids down at Central Oregon Community College. And right prior to that, I talked to a BLM pilot who's flying smoke jumpers. And there are only 8 pilots who fly smoke jumpers for BLM. And when I was talking to this class, I was like, man, he got lucky. And it's like, well, he didn't really. He applied for 4 years. Every year he'd go talk to him again. So it's like, you make your own luck. Like you said, you have to get the ratings in order, and then you have to go out and seek opportunities to be ready to grab them when they pop up.
Yeah,
sure. Hey, Aiden, sorry to interrupt. This is Travis Kinsey. I'm sorry I'm late.
Hey, no worries. How's it going, Travis?
Going well, man.
How's Florida?
Just barging in on you guys here. Florida is hot. I'm driving now to go on a little camping trip, but I missed the first 20 minutes. Apologize.
Cool. No worries. I don't know if you managed to listen to Gareth's interviews on the site, but Gareth's flying a Catalina PBY over in the UK and around Europe air shows.
I did listen to that.
Cool. And Gareth, I'm going to point out you might have questions for Travis. Travis flies in Africa frequently. He sells airplanes over there, so he knows quite a bit about jobs that pop up there. So if you think of anything about Africa, feel free to ask Travis.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Travis.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, not bad. I mean, it's dark and cold here. What's it like in Florida?
Florida, it's hot. I am in aircraft sales, so I really enjoyed your interview with Aiden, and look forward to more.
Oh, fantastic. Good. Well, I'd be interested to know a little bit more about what you do in Africa, because as I understand it, Africa is our Alaska.
It is, really.
Yeah, if you want to do bush flying in Europe, you've got to go down to Africa, and likewise, you guys go off up to Alaska.
It's pretty darn close, yeah.
I think Alaska is more formidable.
Well, I don't know, Aiden, you last time I heard it, you'd been in Africa and picking up a Cessna Caravan?
Yeah,
I flew to Congo for 6 months. I think Alaska is harder flying, but Africa has numerous other hazards that Alaska does not have on the ground, including geopolitical situations.
Yeah.
So it's different.
Yeah, I think that's my main sticking point for going down to Africa is exactly that. I don't mind the flying conditions, but when you're on the ground and you might get shot at, it's just a pretty different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that does. And some countries are pretty safe. Some, if you're working for a good outfit, you usually have a better time of it, because they'll keep track of situations and kind of clue you in. At least that's the feeling I've always had.
Mm.
So, for sure. Let's get back to the Catalina real quick, because I actually have a question about your training in the Catalina, how did your former training to get your JAR, how did that, did it seem pretty applicable?
Well, how did my, okay, so doing my commercial training on multi-engine piston aircraft, how did that translate to flying the Catalina? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, but the JAR is very, from what I understand, is very focused on kind of modern airplanes and modern crew environments. And how did flying an older airplane, was it similar? Or were there differences terms of what they were teaching?
Putting the academic thing to one side, and you know what I did in the type rating for Catalina, you know, we have our own TRTO. Paul Warren Wilson is a certified TRE, type rating examiner, and so that means that we can train and examine ourselves on land and water type ratings on the Catalina. What that involves is we follow it was about a 52-page training manual, and that involves some you know, quite a bit of self-study plus a day of ground school to learn another 52-page flight manual and another supplementary manuals for engines and avionics, familiarize ourselves with the Duxford General Flying Orders, and then take a three-hour written exam. And then an hour or two of flight training, and then a 45-minute flight test. And you know, what we're flying is a twin-engine piston aircraft. So apart from its size, the same principles apply, because when you're when you're flying a twin-engine aircraft and you've been testing a twin-engine aircraft, you know, it's all about how to deal with engine failures after takeoff usually, and how to deal with asymmetric flight, and how to fly an asymmetric circuit, do an asymmetric approach down to an asymmetric committal height, and then making the decision to go round, so you've got an asymmetric go round, and then back around in the circuit, asymmetric landing. And then other than that, dealing with stalls and things like that. So in terms of the training, you know, it's not all glass cockpit when you're flying a Piper Seneca, and it certainly isn't all glass cockpit when you're flying a Catalina. So, you know, apart from size, there isn't a tremendous amount of difference.
But it's way cooler.
Yeah, well, obviously, way cooler. The Catalina is, what she likes to fly. She's a bit like flying a boat. I know she's a flying boat, but she is like flying a boat. I mean, she's quite sort of slow and can be heavy on the controls. Bear in mind that, you know, the controls have no assistance. It's all fly by wire or cable, and she does tend to have a bit of a mind of her own. Her directional stability, because she's got quite a wide wingspan. It's around 106 feet with the floats up, and she's around just a little over 60 foot long. So directional stability is a bit of an issue. So if you want to fly the pink line, you do have to concentrate, because you can't just set her sitting there straight and level in a direction and sit back and relax. You have to concentrate quite a lot all of the time to just keep going along the old pink line. There's a few other little quirks about flying the Catalina. One of them that was in the in the flight manual was rather overbalanced. I haven't actually experienced this one myself, but rudder overbalance can occur if you have excessive side slip angle, and then if you release the rudders, then the rudders can move to a full deflection. As I said, I've not experienced it before, but to get out of it, it's a case of increasing speed, but then you need to trade speed for altitude, and it's not the sort of thing that you want happening low level. There's adverse aileron on yaw, which is something that we can get, but again, it's something I've experienced flying even just a Tiger Moth, that when you're flying these old aircraft, it is really, really important to fly a balanced turn. So it's not like you would lead with the rudder, but certainly needs to be top of mind. So when you are turning the Catalina, you do have to concentrate on aileron and rudder and elevator all at the same time to hold that balanced turn. Whereas I found in more modern aircraft, you can be a little bit more lazy on the rudder and all that sort of thing. There's also another thing I discovered flying the Catalina, and it was, bear in mind, it's the first time that I'd flown an aircraft much bigger than a light twin, is that I was constantly having to adjust the elevator. And that was simply because I've got people walking around in the back. And I've never had people walking around in the back before. So, adjusting elevator trim is something I find that I'm regularly doing. The stall is pretty benign. You get very little buffet. It's quite a big, heavy aircraft, so spotting the stall is very much a case of keeping an eye on the VSI. It's a twin-engine aircraft, but those two engines are actually quite close together, so flying asymmetric isn't too difficult. I think the critical engine is, having to think for a second, what direction my props are going in, is the left engine. But nevertheless, the fact that the two engines aren't terribly far apart means that when you are flying asymmetric, it's not too heavy on the rudder. A lot of twin engine aircraft are, the remaining engine might take you to the scene of the accident. Whereas the Catalina, she's got plenty of power. With max continuous, she'll still develop a 1,050 brake horsepower, so we can still climb at 200 feet per minute on one engine. So that's pretty good. Trying to think of what else is kind of different about her. Takeoff, we do have to do a bit of a wheelie, get that nose wheel off the ground pretty quick, because the nose wheel tends to shimmer or shimmy. Although it's a cast ring wheel, the axle's not that far behind the Oleo, so we do get nose wheel shimming, so we need to get that off the runway quite quick. Because rudder control is so important, and also because the way we steer on the ground is with differential braking, although we may use differential thrust as well, differential braking is the main means of steering on the ground. So having the position of your rudders, your rudder bar, should I say, is very important. And because after takeoff, we can move the rudder bars further away, or we can move the toe brakes less upright, so we're more comfortable in flight. But when it comes to being on the ground and takeoff and landing, it's very important to make sure those rudder pedals are are close enough to you, so you can get maximum deflection on the rudder pedals, and at the same time on the same side you can get maximum braking with the toe brakes. Yeah, I mean that's all the kind of things I can think of about Catalina. I mean she was much, the cockpit's quite, is set quite high compared.
What's that?
No, I heard.
We got someone else trying to get in here.
It's
coming up hard to figure out when someone else is getting on. So, Gareth, why don't you just continue saying the flight deck set up pretty high, huh?
Yeah, it is. I don't know the dimension how high, but you know, she is quite high. I mean, it's not like a 747 or a 737 high. But when you're used to flying a light twin like a Piper Seneca, when you're back, you're way down low like in just any light aircraft, and then you're stuck in a 12-ton aircraft with 106-foot wingspan and 60-odd-foot long, with people walking around inside and the cockpit's up really high. You would kind of expect it to be really difficult, but the odd thing was that I didn't find it too bad at all, because you come in on an approach and I was thinking, okay, well, I'm this much higher up because I'm this much forward of the wing, and I'm my cockpit's higher than I'm used to, and there was no analysis of that really going on. You just got that seat of the pants feel. And I just found that I was able to land the aircraft very well.
Cool. And the other pilots you're working with, a lot of them come from airline backgrounds, don't they?
Yeah, they do. We've got quite a mixture of pilots. We've got six captains and five co-pilots. Paul Warren Wilson, who is the founder of the organisation, is the chief pilot. He's ex-RAF squadron leader and retired from the RAF, and he used to be a Harrier instructor. He's now captain flying 747s for Cathay Pacific. Our deputy chief, Rob Brooking, he's ex-British Airways 747 captain, retired. There's Paul Mackay. He's a guest pilot rather than a shareholder, but he's an ex-CAA test pilot. He left them recently. He's now with Pilatus, who are based in Lucerne in Switzerland. You might know about that. Yeah, so now next time you're in Switzerland, maybe we can fix up for you to have a chat with him. He's a great bloke. You'd really like him. He's very down to earth.
Yeah, I might try that.
Yeah, we'll talk about it after the call and see if we can fix something up. There's John Warman. He's RAF retired. He used to fly Shackleton's, and he's also used to fly 747s. For Cathay. Derek Head, he's ex-RAF, retired. He used to fly Hercules, and he's now a captain on a 737 for Thompson. And there's Seb Mazzuchetti, who he's a first officer on A320 Air France. And then the co-pilot, Spiny Norman, he's ex-Royal Navy. He's retired. He used to be a helicopter instructor. He's now a business jet simulator instructor. Fritz Eger. Fritz is from Austria, and I've only met Fritz a couple of times, and I can't remember who he's actually flying for at the moment, but I know he's flying commercially. Jeff Boiling, he's a flying instructor with a school that I renewed my multi-engine incident rating with. And then our latest latest recruit is Dave Barlow, and he's flying BA-146 for CityJet. And then there's me. rub my shoulders with a lot of really experienced guys.
Yeah, what drew them to the Catalina in particular? I mean, did they just want to get back to a different type of flying away from the jets for a while, or did they have an interest in the Catalina or the Catalina organization prior to finding Little Miss Pickup?
You know, I haven't quizzed each of them on why they're doing it, but you can imagine the difference between flying an airliner and flying a Catalina. Flying an airliner is, I don't do it, but from what I can gather, you get to about 200 feet and you put the autopilot on and you've already programmed in a standard instrument departure and a route onto the airway. And, it's not, you're monitoring systems, whereas flying the Catalina is very, very hands-on, down-to-earth kind of flying. And I'm sure it's something that people who are flying airliners really get the urge to come back to.
Yeah, so like the airlines are a good job, but they're not necessarily giving you your a real flying fix.
No, I don't think they're feeding your soul in terms of real seat the pants, rudder, and stick flying. Certainly the Catalina does that.
That's just a kind of a personal question for you then, because I know you were headed towards airlines, and that was kind of your fantasy to be an airline pilot. After working with these guys who are flying for the airlines and are coming back to clean it, Catalina to get the fix, that kind of make you feel like this might have been a better path?
It's difficult. I mean, I suppose if I'm honest, I'd still like the T-shirt, the airline T-shirt. I'd still like to say, yeah, I did it. I got to fly the jets. I got to fly the shiny, pointy things. I would actually be quite happy now just carrying on flying down-to-earth kind of stuff. If I could carry on flying old warbirds, I would be happy as Larry. I really would. Although it's been a difficult journey, and not necessarily an ideal journey, and it has come late in life, I'm actually quite happy with it. I just need to be able to do it more.
Yeah, you need to get that P-47 also.
Well, I'm thinking B-25 actually. Yeah.
Awesome.
Watch this space. I've got the bug now. It's funny actually, because I was talking to the guys as it happens, who owns the B-17, and they were talking about doing flight engineer courses on the B-17. So I've put my hand up for that, because apart from being just cool doing it, it's a part of that sneaky route into the front, isn't it?
Yeah. So once you're kind of in that world with the old warbirds, you're starting to make the connections in that world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not shy of doing it. I don't know if I mentioned to you that I actually handed my notice in to my IT job at the beginning of January. So,
congrats.
I thank you all. No offense, Mike, but I've kind of had my fill of that, and I want to go back into aviation. So, and hopefully I've got a little bit of a land deal on the go, and that may actually, provide the resources to be able to it kind of set me free to be able to get back into aviation properly. And yeah, so really, watch your space.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm not kidding about that B-25.
That, yeah, I'm jealous of that. I was actually just at an air ambulance operator, but the owner of the company just bought a B-17. So I walked in their hangar, and there's a B-17 sitting there. I was like, oh, my goodness, you don't get... It's like, guys, you got to let me take a video.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, apart from seeing the B-17 in the hangar, the last time I saw it was in Dublin at the Flight Fest, and we were both stuck in the display hold together at about 500 foot vertical separation. And you know, it's one of those days where you just wish you had a camera attached to your head, so you could just take that snapshot as you see the form of a B-17 flying across your windscreen like it was over Hamburg in 1943, and those are the sort of experiences that just come all the time when you're doing this sort of air show work. I was so lucky on the first air show that I actually got to fly co-pilot. It was the Royal International Air Tattoo, which, I mean, you guys might argue this, but apparently it's the largest military air show in the world. It has everything there, absolutely everything there. And there's me in the right-hand seat of a 70-year-old warbird flying at the Royal International Air Tattoo. I couldn't believe it. How the hell did I do it? I had to pinch myself. We had 100,000 spectators each day, so 2 days. And on the, second day, we were doing a simulated Dumbo mission, which is, you know, where we would be flying these like dumbbell type, you can imagine, like it's kind of like a figure of eight along the display line, pretending we're looking for a downed airman, along with the Red Bull B-25 and a Corsair. I mean, you couldn't make it up, could you? We're taxiing out and we're taxiing past a Vulcan, a Lancaster, we got a Meteor. I can't remember the aircraft types that were before and after us, but you know, it was like Bagram Air Base on a good day. Everyone on this tight schedule, minute by minute, just having to be, you know, at that holding point, bang on time, within seconds, to make sure that you're getting on the runway, clear for takeoff, just after the previous aircraft has exited the runway, and you make sure that you do your display within your allotted time and get back on the runway vacated before the next one. Otherwise, you put everybody else out of joint. I mean, it was just fantastic. Absolutely amazing experience.
So now, when you're flying, obviously the captain you're flying with is pretty experienced at doing these air shows, but what's expected of you as the co-pilot? And that was your first air show, one of the bigger ones. Did you feel like you could keep up with the workload, or was it a scrambling?
Actually, I did surprise myself. You know, when you do, when you're in that situation, you actually find yourself quite nervous before you get in the seat. But once you're in the seat and you've got your checklist out and you're into procedures and you're into just doing what you've been trained to do, then the nerves go away and you just get on with the job. And you know, so in terms of what's involved, you know, for the co-pilot, I mean, obviously it's important to explain that it's the captain has the what we call the DA, or the display authorization. So you know, by definition, he's in command and he's flying the aircraft. But the co-pilot, he's not just self-loading baggage. He's got a lot to do. So, I mean, to begin with, I'll attend the display briefing with the captain, where we'll go to a weather brief, and at the same time look out the window. We'll get explained all the display parameters, which will involve minimum heights and maximum speeds. Of course, these are variable on aircraft type. We'll get explained where the crowd line is and where the display line is. The display line, again, could be variable on aircraft type. And also explain the other no-fly areas like public car parks. But really importantly, we get to see the timings of all the aircraft and more importantly than anything, our display slot. But it's important for us to know, you know, which aircraft is before us, which aircraft is after us, exactly what point we must be at the holding point for the runway ready for departure after the previous display aircraft has landed, and what time we must be on the ground and vacating the runway before the next aircraft is ready for takeoff. And also because, you know, we're going to know what time we need to be at those particular points, we need to make sure that, you know, say, for example, we're on static display. We need to plan well ahead and prep the aircraft. So I'll liaise with the crew chief and the ground crew to prep the aircraft for departure, make sure that all the public have left the aircraft, everything is stowed away. I'll do a check-a type walk round, make sure that all the locks have been removed. I need to make sure that you know, the fuel's been dipped, the oil's been checked, that the hydraulics been checked, the fuel's had its has been drained, and we've had a look, make sure there's no water in it. You know, it's a host of things to make sure that the aircraft is actually ready for departure. The other thing I'll be doing is I'll be reading the checklists. You know, once we're actually in the aircraft and we're getting going. So I'll read the checklist. It's normally you expect a command and response, but because none of us are flying the aircraft that regularly, what I'll do is I'll do a command and answer, and then the captain will repeat the answer and make sure that that particular item has actually been done. What else? I'll be doing radio communications, so I'll contact dispatch for pushback and engine start. I'll contact tower for taxi and takeoff clearances. I'll handle the manifold pressures and props and mixtures required on takeoff and landing, which is normal for any flight, but, you know, same again for the air display. During the actual display, I'll be engine monitoring, just checking the T's and P's. And also during the display, it depends on the captain, but I may be asked by the captain to adjust manifold pressure and props and mixture, because if he needs more power or less power, depending on the maneuver, or whether we've got floats coming up and down or gear going up and down, he may want to continue just steering the aircraft, and he doesn't want to take his hands away to be operating those levers. So he will actually say, look, I want this manifold pressure, this RPM. I've been responsible for raising and lowering the floats, because that's one of the things we do in the display, so I let them know they're in transit and up and down. Also switching landing lights on and off. You know, the crowd kind of like that. And also, you know, importantly, I'll warn the captain if we're looking like we're going to exceed any of the flight parameters. So, for example, you know, if we're going to exceed the display line or the crowd line or any of these no-go areas that we've already been briefed on, if the speed is dropping to 85 knots, for example, and decreasing, if the angle of bank is at 45 degrees and increasing. These are things I need to let the captain know, because he's concentrating heavily on trying to do this constant dumbbell maneuver. So I provide those warnings to him. And also, I keep an eye out for traffic separation, because as I mentioned before, you know, we're not always a solo display. You know, as I said, at the Air Tattoo, we had the B-25 and Corsair flying top cover in a simulated Dumbo mission, and then at Flight Fest, we had a B-17 in the display hold with us. And of course, you've got the aircraft displaying before you, and you've got the aircraft displaying after you. And then sort of after that, it's what you'd expect to assist with emergencies, you know, if we have an engine failure or if gear fails to go down or gear fails to go up. So, there's a lot to do, and the thing I found, and as I said, the Air Tattoo, that was my very first go, I knew I was going to have quite a bit to do, but I didn't really realise quite how much until I was actually doing it, and I realised that I was not sitting back and enjoying the show. I was so busy, I didn't see the show. You know?
And the captain's expecting you to be able to perform your task.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, there's a lot to do, because, I mean, he's got a huge responsibility, you know, for the aircraft and for the public and, you know, and I'm there to support him, and those are things I do to support him, so he can deliver the display.
How long does a typical display take from like engine start to shut down?
Engine start to shut down. That's a difficult one, because that could vary greatly, because that's such a long time. I mean, that could be an hour, whereas your actual display might only be 8 minutes. So it depends on how many aircraft there are all queuing up to do their display. That's a tough one to answer. I can really tell you is that we'll probably be displaying for about 8 minutes, and we have to do whatever's necessary to get to that point where we'll be at that runway hold the moment just before the previous aircraft has vacated the runway, so that the moment we get takeoff clearance or we get clearance to line up and hold. It's all down to set. Well, certainly it was at Royal International Air Tattoo. Other air shows might not quite be as tight. I don't know, but that was really tight.
It's clearly not like a normal airline flight then, where you're just going to take off, autopilot on, cruise for 3 hours, and then land. And I also know that plane will carry a ton of gas. Do you just put a lot of gas on board, or do you ever have instances where you're holding so long on the ground, or you have to hold in a holding pattern in the air that fuel becomes a concern to get the whole flight done?
Yeah. Well, again, it kind of depends. If I think on that particular show, we weren't actually that far from home, and we didn't refuel at any point when we were at RAF Fairford. So we carried enough fuel in order to, we plotted and calculated our fuel so that we could depart Duxford, get to RAF Fairford, do two displays, and get home again with our normal contingency and reserve.
Okay, so, well, that plane carried like 80 hours of fuel.
She carries, 729 imperial gallons each side, so that's 1,458 imperial gallons. So it's a huge amount of fuel, which would allow us to fly for probably something like 12 and a half hours or something like that. She burns about 65 imperial gallons an hour. I've got a calculator on me. Anyway, it'll keep us going. It'll keep us going for a long time. And so for us to fly from Duxford to RAF Fairford, do two 8-minute displays plus taxi and everything, it's just more than enough. More than enough. But nevertheless,
what is the radio work like on those flights? I mean, I could just imagine that's pretty busy.
Actually, you'd be surprised. It's not. We don't talk unless we talk to.
Okay.
So, as I said, you know, we will contact dispatch for a pushback and engine start. We'll talk to the tower for taxi clearance and takeoff clearance, and we'll stay with the tower during the display. They're not going to talk to us other than is the display complete? Or I will say, you know, we've completed our display, and they'll say you're clear to land, and then you may go to ground after that.
Cool. What are you doing for navigation? Did you say you've got a ground briefing, you've got areas you can't go into, you're supposed to fly a certain pattern? I mean, it's an old airplane. Do you use GPS, or are you just using visual reference to the ground and charts?
Yeah, it's all VFR for an air display. There's no chance of it going IFR. If it was IFR, we wouldn't be displaying. You're never actually far from the runway during the display, certainly not in the Catalina. I mean, if you're flying a Typhoon or a Raptor, you might find yourself a little way off at times, but and quite high up. But with us, you know, we'll be displaying, you know, between, say, 300 and 150 feet off the ground and well within the perimeter of the airfield and all VFR. All visual. So in terms of navigation, you know, for me, it's just important to make sure that I would advise the captain if I feel we may be exceeding the display line or we may be going over any of the no-go areas, particularly the crowd or anything like that. I mean, obviously they know what they're doing, but I'm just there as a backup to advise if I see anything.
Right. They're concentrating on flying the plane, and they might just be drifting towards a boundary or something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, at RIA, John turned to me just said, just confirm for me the display line, because the aircraft was orientated in such a position where he was trying to turn in, but he didn't have a very clear field of view from the left-hand seat. So I just give him a little bit of a pointer as to exactly where it was. So just little things like that, just to help out.
Cool. Is there after these shows, do you hang out with the other pilots quite a bit and everybody sit down and have a beer? Or?
Oh, yes. Yeah, every show I've been to, there's been an after-show party, and they do vary. I'll just try and think back of the shows that I have actually been to, and let's see. The first show I went to with the Catalina, I actually went as ground crew to Wies, which is what used to be RAF Lahrbrück in Germany, and there was an after-show party there in the old officers' mess. And that was, apart from a few cute wing walkers, that was mostly blokes and just a boozer. But it was good nonetheless. And then, in complete contrast to that, I went to a show for Security Seville, which is in Marseille in southern France, and it was their 50th anniversary. It's a water bombing base, And we were invited because our Catalina was an airframe that they had back in the 60s. So anyway, you know, after a fantastic show, which is a, probably an hour's conversation on its own, we had an after-show party at a chateau, and instead of beers, it was all champagne, and it was typically French. And a fantastic experience. And then at the Royal International Air Tattoo, again, that was mostly blokes, although obviously there's a lot of military there, so you do have a lot of girls in the military as air crew. So there's an enormous party there around a stealth UAV, and with Mexican sort of Latino type dancers with feathers and thongs and, you know, and it's every show there's an after show party. Everyone's very well behaved, as you can imagine.
Rough
yeah.
life.
It's tough. It's really tough. You know, there's other places, like, you know, if you go to, I don't know if you heard of Scaleria, which is near Salzburg on the Wolfgangsee in Austria. That's a, I think it's biannual seaplane event. And that is probably more like the French event, where it's all very cultural with string orchestras and things like that. You know, you get such a fantastic cross-section of experiences going to all these different shows. Yeah.
So now that we're done with some of these shows on the main continent, what's it like flying an old warbird back into Europe proper, I mean, in terms of filing flight plans? And I mean, do you file VFR, or do they don't fly IFR too much with the Catalina?
Although, yeah, the Catalina is fully IFR, and most of the crew are IFR trained. We never fly an IFR, although, you know, we do fly through a bit of cloud bound then. We do fly a VFR. We'll file a VFR flight plan with NATS, or National Air Traffic Service. And that will take us, you know, that flight plan can take us anywhere within Europe. And the only thing really that you notice is that you'll go from one flight to another flight information region, and then you start talking to somebody with an accent. And that can be the biggest challenge, is talking to somebody with an accent. So, you know, that kind of communication, but, you know, other than that, the rules and regs are all pretty much the same.
Yep, that's nice. And do they know what you are when you show up on when you talk to air traffic control? They understand you're an old plane that might go slower than they're used to, or are they usually I think the controllers would think it's pretty cool that you're an old plane, old warbird.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you do find yourself get slightly preferential treatment, because during the air show season, you're flying around a warbird, you know, you might get cut some slack, or, you know, a special VFR across a bit of space, they'll let you across and all that sort of thing. But, you know, it's, and sometimes you can hear the air traffic controller's kind of spirit lift a little bit when they hear that they're talking to an old warbird, you know.
What's your call sign when you're talking to them?
We always use our registration, which is, I should remember this, shouldn't I? Golf Papa Bravo Yankee Alpha.
You can't use something cool like this is PBY or this is a Catalina Rescue 1.
No, well, sometimes at an air show we might get given a call sign, So whilst when we're in the airshow environment, we might call ourselves just be called Catalina. But it, you know, it is down to the air traffic controller at the end of the day. Just normally you should go by your aircraft registration. But sometimes at air shows, you do just go by Catalina.
How does your organization get these bookings at these air shows? They're kind of all over the place.
I think it's a bit of an acquired art, but at the moment we've got Natalie, who's an administrator and our display bookings manager. So she's employed full time. And as well as the administration, she will contact all the air show organisers throughout the UK and Europe, and she will send them quotes. And if they accept our quote and they want us there, then we'll get a booking. And you know, we do. At the moment, it's quite early in the year. Although we're almost into April, a lot of these air shows still don't know their budgets. So you tend to know a little bit last thing. But you know, one of our unique selling points is the fact that is that our aircraft reliability is very, very good. We have never not turned up to an air show because the aircraft's been US. That just doesn't happen. And also, we've got crew availability. As I said, we've got like six captains and five co-pilots and a number of even greater number of ground crew and crew chiefs. So we are able to deliver, and we're able to deliver at short notice very often as well.
And in the winter, like you say, it's the off season now. So you spend the winter kind of wrenching on the plane, and it's the winter's just spent getting the plane ready. Is that correct?
This is my kind of second life. Because obviously when at the end of the air show season, which is between what we call our winter maintenance season between October and March, is when we will do everything necessary to get the aircraft ready for the next season. The aircraft is maintained in accordance with a maintenance schedule approved by the CAA at 50 hours, 100, 200, 400 flying hours. And then she'll go through throughout that winter period a long schedule of various different things. Also important to mention at this point that Gary Short, he's our chief engineer and a fully qualified engineer. We've got Toby. He comes in from the Shuttleworth collection. Again, he's a fully qualified engineer. And then we've got what we call the Cat Pack, which is a group of volunteers that come from all walks of life. And I, at this stage of the game, I fit in with volunteers. So, it's just important to mention that a lot of work you do on an aircraft has to be certified and it has to be done by a qualified engineer. So if I'm involved in any part of that is under direct supervision and leadership of somebody who's qualified to do it. But the kind of things that I would do is anything from like cleaning, and I'll do anti-corrosion type work, rubbing down, edge priming and painting. I'll do fabric repairs because we've got various control services and other parts of the wing which are fabric covered. I've got involved in engine compression tests, changing and cleaning spark plugs, taking the cowlings off and the cowl flaps off, taking the exhausts off, the air intake and the carburetor off. I've had the starboard nose gear door off. The nose gear door pins and the hydraulic actuators. At the port aileron bell crank, as the bearings we spray down, stuck that back on. What else? Yeah,
it's a good way to get to know the airplane.
It is, yeah. I mean, I had the left aileron off, I know that. Cockpit, I had the cabin seats out, I changed the hydraulic filter at one point. I helped remove the forward wing strut, also jacked the plane up, removed the wheels, cleaned up the brakes, took the bearings out, cleaned the bearings out and re-greased those. Test lower and range the undercarriage and go through various emergency procedures whilst it's up on its jacks. I mean, I get to do an awful lot of different things, and as I said before, it's under supervision, but it just gives you a much better and more in-depth understanding of the aircraft you're flying, and also you get to spend the day with a group of like-minded blokes, all having fun, messing around with the plane. But obviously it's a serious job, can you get done?
Cool. Anyone else have any questions? I've been kind of hogging all the question time. All right. Well, I'll forge ahead then. Do you have any thoughts of getting an engineer rating and actually doing some more official wrenching on the plane?
I'm a pilot, and that's what I really want to do, but spending a Sunday working with these guys is fun, and it helps me learn more about the aircraft I'm flying. That's the reason why I'm doing it. I mean, if there were ever a time where, for one reason or another, that I was unable to fly, then that's definitely something I'd look at doing.
Suspect, too, that just all this work with the engineers makes it easier to troubleshoot any problems because you can talk to them in a language they understand better and you have a better understanding of the airplane.
Yeah, it does. And, if I'm flicking the switch for the carpet, I know what's going on under the cowling. I know what actuator, what motor's turning, what actuator's moving, and what flaps are turning. And if I flick a switch on the for the firewall shut off, I know what's going on. I know exactly what's closing on the right side and what's closing on the left side. The hydraulics, the fuel, the oil, and on the left side is just the fuel and the oil, but I actually know the components and where they're moving. And it just gives you that extra feeling of confidence that you're not just sitting there flicking switches, you know precisely what is going on when you flip that switch. And also when it comes to emergency procedures for raising and lowering the undercarriage, I know how it all works. It's not trying to just learn a sequence of events without fully understanding precisely what's going on. And that's also important because if you're the pilot and you're flying the aircraft and you know that if you're trying to lower the gear because the hydraulics have failed, and you know that your crew chief is running around trying to lower three separate gears, you know what you've got to do in order to help him because you know exactly what he is doing. Enjoy.
Did you guys take this plane into the water at all, or did you keep it pretty much on land?
The places that we take the aircraft on the water, because it's only fresh water that will go on because of obviously the salt water you get corrosion. And also the type ratings are either land or water, so not all of the pilots have a water type rating. But the two places where we would normally put the aircraft on water would be Biscarrosse in southwest France, or Scaleria, as I said, is in Salzburg on the Wolfgang Sea in Austria. They're really the only two places where we would land on water. It's usually as I said, Scaleri, I think he's once every 2 years. Viscarossa, I think that's actually annual. I'm really tempted to Google that one because I've heard some good stuff about it. But yeah, definitely, you know, if you could Google Viscarossa and Scaleri, you just find out just what a fan these huge, it's like seaplane, float plane flyings they are, and just everything is there. You know, fantastic events.
Cool. Are you looking at getting your float rating then, at some point?
Yeah, I'd like to do the water side of it. Although I kind of doubt that I'm going to be doing it this year. It's more likely that I'll be doing it next year, but it's definitely on the cards. I mean, it's definitely something I want to do. And actually, sort of flying float planes is something that intrigues me anyway. And you know, if all things going well this year, I think it's one of the likely routes I'm going to take back into commercial aviation.
Cool. I know Alex just posted a job that he'd heard about in the Andaman Islands over actually where that Malaysian jet might be lost, but they were flying a caravan on floats. It sounded pretty cool. And it's over in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah. I've got this picture in my head, Eamon. Indian Ocean, a plane with floats. It doesn't get much better than that, does it?
I mean, that would be pretty cool. I know I looked at it closely. I was like, oh, that could be interesting. I know Alex looked at it too, but he's got his family. And that would have been pretty cool. And that job will probably pop up again, is my feeling.
Yeah, and I'm kind of hoping I'm going to be properly on the market very, very soon and be in a position to pursue those sort of jobs.
Yeah, they're out there. I know we talked about Maldives Air Taxi quite a bit. They're looking for captains, but you need twin otter time and some significant amount of float time. But it's kind of been really good little jobs. They found some float jobs in China, too, which looks kind of interesting. So,
well, you know,
Catalina, it might be a route into another side of commercial aviation for you.
You think so?
Possibly.
I kind of thought it might be.
At these air shows, have you met any pilots do the air show flying as a full-time living, where they actually make money off of it?
No. No. Well, actually, no, I'm telling a lie. I think that the guys who like fly Red Bull, like the B-25, the Corsair, and they've got other aircraft in their fleet, they were employed by Red Bull. And although I'm not sure that they're how full-time they're employed or whether they're just employed during the air show season, but they are paid by Red Bull to fly aircraft at air shows. And then you've got the guys who fly the, what aircraft is it? There's the wing walking. Mainly the aircraft.
Oh, like,
yeah,
like
you know.
Travel Air or something like that, Waco, Waco.
It's right on the tip of my tongue. A biplane. But obviously they've been paid by, one year it was Cadbury's Crunchy, who were sponsoring those aircraft. So they're getting paid to fly air show events. Anyone who's in the military, they're getting paid to fly air show events. It's only really the privately owned aircraft like ours where the pilots aren't really doing it for any gain. Obviously we charge to attend an air show, but it really does only just cover our costs. It's not enough to pay pilots a living wage, and it's very seasonal as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your last email about the accounting organization also. that's an international organization?
Well, our organization is basically Catalina Aircraft Limited. The capital cost of the Catalina is funded by 20 group members, and that's through purchase of shares in Catalina Aircraft Limited. So there's 20 shares at £1 each. And also loans to Catalina Aircraft, which would be £17,499. So basically, if you want a 20th share of Catalina, you pay £17,500. But it's set up in this what you might think is slightly peculiar way, just to make sure that if any one of us went under a bus, you know, Catalina Aircraft will still have control of their aircraft, and you know, the people who inherited your estate would still get your £17,500 back. So it's a very fair way of doing it, but making sure the aircraft remains in control of the people who love her and look after her. The actual aircraft is operated by Plain Sailing, who pay the costs and they retain the income from the aircraft. And the income comes from shareholders, like myself, who each pay £150 a month. Catalina Society memberships and donations. There's the airshow revenue, i.e. what we charge to actually attend an airshow. Any aircraft leasing revenue, so we could lease the aircraft with crew to a film company, for example. And in those circumstances, I think about 20% of that revenue does in fact go to Catalina Aircraft Limited. And then also there's the sales of merchandise. We'll set up a stall at every air show, or almost every air show we go to. We set up a stall and we flog T-shirts and mugs and baseball caps and, you know, all sorts, just to raise a little bit more money. And then the other part of the organisation, as I mentioned, you've got the Catalina Society, but there are certain members of the society who call the Cat Pack. And they're not only members of the society, they also volunteer their help. And those are the guys who are turning up on Sundays and some days during the week to help our chief engineer do work on the aircraft. So that's kind of general organisation of it.
Cool.
So how much time have you actually been spending on this whole part of your life during the busy season, let's say?
Apart from obviously the study I've put into the type rating and the exams I've taken and the flight training and attending the air shows, I think2012-2013 winter season, I did 70 hours of wrenching. So that was, you know, almost every Sunday over that period. And this maintenance period, I've been up there every Sunday except two, and I'll be up there tomorrow. So when we finish this call, I'm going to go and grab myself a cup of coffee and go to bed, and I'll be up at 6:30, and I'll jump in my car and I'll drive to Duxford and I'll go and get filthy.
That sounds heavy. I tell you what, from when we first started emailing, it sounds like you're pretty happy with the way this is all gone.
I couldn't have wished for more. I feel like I've worked hard for it, and I've earned it, and I've seized the opportunity, and I've put a lot into it, and it's given me an awful lot back. You know, I really enjoy every moment I spend involved with the Catalina. It's, you know, it's not just the aircraft, it's not just the flying. You know, it's the people, it's the travel, not least the parties.
Cool. I think we'll start wrapping this up. If does anybody have any other questions, or Travis, if you're still there, Gareth, any questions about Africa?
Not off the top of my head, Travis. So, you know, any once before I met someone who was in aircraft sales, and you know, at one point in time, it did cross my mind that maybe that would be something, you know, I could do. You know, that's obviously not something that I pursued, and one of the reasons why I haven't pursued flying in Africa is, as Aidan described, it's quite a big decision. It's not Alaska, is it? You know, run around Alaska with AK-47s, hunting season. I don't know. it's definitely something, but you know, it's something that I am prepared to look at some point. But I've just got to get past this hurdle that I'm in at the moment, where I need to just completely free myself of IT and do my land deal, and then, you know, the world's my oyster.
Cool. Well, maybe we'll see you in Seattle this summer.
Do you know what? Watch your space, mate, because I'd love to dip over to Seattle and have a few beers and look over the marina and see some float planes and share a few beers. Yeah, that'd be cool.
Well, we've got a guy, he used to fly for Kenmore, and he's going to be on the site soon. He just got a job flying for Everett Air Cargo, flying DC-6s. He's a flight engineer now for him. And you all can talk about round engines together.
I'm learning more and more about it all the time. I mean, as I said, a long time ago, I had to pass all those exams, and one of them was all about engines and everything. But you know, until you get your hands dirty and you pull bits off and look inside, and you're working with a guy who knows all about it, and he wants to impart his knowledge to you. There's no substitute for that. You know, just chuck the book away and just work with someone like that for a few weeks, and you learn so much more.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So Travis, how's the how are the 206s doing? Are they back up flying in Tanzania there?
Sorry, Aidan, were you talking to me then?
Oh, I was actually talking to Travis there. He's at a company he knows. A humanitarian aid group that flies 206 around. I was just curious whether they've gotten over there and gotten up and going again.
He might have dropped off.
Oh, might have. Oh, well, might have lost Travis.
Oh,
well. Next week in Miami.
Never mind. I'll see some other time, Travis. I need board.
No, I think the calls sometimes drop off, but no,
I think he said he was driving too.
Oh, yeah. But that was great, Garrett. That's I was curious how it all gone. I mean, it just really sounds like it's gone good, it's gone well. So yeah, maybe we will see you here in Seattle, and or else maybe in the UK. Maybe I'll snag a ride on Little Miss Pickup.
Yeah. Just give us a shout, and if there's any possibility of doing that. I'll do my best to make it happen.
Cool, that'd be fun. If not, I'll find your guy for Pilatus there over in Switzerland. Probably wouldn't be till this fall, but back to Europe for some climbing.
I figured that might be one of your preferred destinations, so give us a shout, and I'm very, very happy to drop him a line and see if he'll have a chat with you. He's a super bloke, really down to earth. And I'm sure he would.
Cool. I'd love to look at the PC-12 a little bit more. Pilatus Quarters is one of my favorites. So, man, if we get to Pilatus after, that'd be awesome. But I'll be in touch on that. It'll probably take a while to set up, but definitely be in touch.
Okie dokie.
Cool. Well, thanks for calling in, and get some sleep and get back to work on the plane tomorrow.
I will. All right.
All right, thanks.
Yeah.
Ciao.
Thanks a lot, Gareth.
Okay, take care, guys. Cheers.
Yeah, cheers. Bye.
Bye.